session number 19940, reel 1.
Marcel Olivier, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Paris on the 6th of February 1921.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family background, please?
Well, my family background was from Brittany and Normandy. My grandfather was a wine merchant in Le Havre. And my great-grandfather fought with Courbet in what was not to become Indochina.
And did you grow up and have your schooling in Paris?
No, I went to the... In 1929, my father was offered an important job for him in Guadeloupe in the West Indies. And I lived in the West Indies until 1938.
In Guadeloupe?
Guadeloupe and Martinique, yes. And I went to college, to a secondary school there.
What was life like in the French West Indies?
Well, in those days it was pretty rough compared to today because there was no frigidaire, no nothing. I mean, sometimes you had a little bit of European food brought on the liners and you could buy a little bit from them. Otherwise, you lived a very tin life for butter, for milk, for also a lot of things were in tins. And if you wanted ice, you have to buy pieces of ice and put them in a box. And there were very few bridges and very few roads and no electricity in many places, even in the cities.
Was there a very big French population there?
Well, it's all French. Guadeloupe and Martinique, the local people were French citizens too. I mean, we didn't have any, they were French citizens way before the war. I mean, actually, Guadeloupe and Martinique and were the two oldest French ex-colonies for over 350 years in those days.
Were conditions peaceful there?
Oh, yes, well, there was. Only once there was trouble with the sugarcane workers, but everybody knew everybody. I went to secondary school. I was one of the few whites. Even my professors had studied in France, but most of them were black, colored people. I never had any problem. In those days, people were not, you know, resenting a lot of things like today.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
Well, I left for some personal reason, family reason. I left my family in 1938 and as a élève mécanicien on a steamship, very old steamship, which was used as a sister ship to the ship it was carrying convict from Nantes to go to Cayenne, the SS Sèvres of the Compagnie Nantaise. And after that I left it and I joined another French merchantman, ex-German, the Arizona. And that's when I was on board that ship, that the war started. And we were in the West Indies when the war started. We were going down to Chile, which we did. On the way back from Chile, loaded with all sort of things, copper, nitrate, and all that, we went to Halifax to join a convoy. It was one of the largest convoy in those days. 57 ships, speed 7 knots at the most. British battleship and two French submarines, the Bevezier and another one, escorted us. Then off to Newfoundland, a terrific storm came and the bolt holding the propeller shaft broke. And we drifted for about a day while we repaired and we never saw the convoy again, but we reached England safely just before Christmas, 39. Then I moved to a fast motor ship, the Jean-Louis Elde, very nice, modern ship for those days, very much like the Germans and the Swedish had, 18 knots, and we were used to do convoy all by ourselves between the United States and France, carrying planes, boxes of planes on the deck, ammunition, anything. And that's where, when France was invaded, we left New York about a few days afterward, all by ourselves. But because of the trouble, armistice coming, 2 or 3 days before we got to Ireland, we were told to get into a convoy. very slow convoy. We were attacked at dusk by submarines. Several ships were sunk, so we took off again. Then, when we reached the Irish Sea, there were ships everywhere, like if a fox had got into a chicken house. Every kind of ships, everybody sort of turning around and turning around. And a friend of mine, we had planned to throw anything we could floating to avoid, because we didn't want to go to France. We didn't want to accept any kind of armistice or anything. So luckily, some orders must have come between the owners of the ship or the British authority or whatever. So we finally went to Milford Haven and from there to Liverpool. And we were there at the end of June where I joined the Free French Forces for the first time. I mean, singing. And in fact, I sang in two places. And on the 3rd of July, the British Navy during the night took over the ship. I'm the one who received them. They came with gun, pistol and all that on board. And took them, because we had not unloaded yet, you see, we were still loaded with all those planes and all those things. And we were not taken to camp like the military, the naval ship, warship. We were just asked to get into dock into Liverpool, which we did. And on the 7th of July, my friend and I, we told the captain we were leaving, joined Free France, and they did every type of pressure they could for us not to go. We did. And we got to the Olympia in London on the 7th of July.
What kind of pressure did they put on you?
Well, they told us we could not do that. I mean, we would be deserters. We had to obey our government. We had to, our families and all that. And so forth. They did all sorts of things. Even the representative of the ship owners tried to stop us. In fact, they kept our papers, everything. And on the British side, nobody encouraged us very much to stay, because after Mers El Kebir, I was in Liverpool where there was all thousands and thousands of French sailors in entry, you know. And they all wanted, most of them wanted to go back because Mers El Kebir, politically, probably a good thing for Sir Winston Churchill, but for Franco-British naval relations, it was a disaster. And I'm sure many warships would have joined later on, or there would have been less bitterness even up to today if Mers El Kebir had not taken place. You know all about Mers El Kebir. And I was there in the Olympia. We had nowhere to sleep. We slept on the concrete and all that. We had food because a foreign legion from the French Expeditionary Corps in Narvik, 665 of them had stayed in England. And many of our supplies for this expeditionary corps were stored in London. So we were able to draw all kinds of things they were able from those stores and feed us. On the 14th of July, because I spoke English and I was still a civilian, I was given half crown and I was told I would be an emissary between the Olympia and de Gaulle's tiny little building on the embankment. And I was sent with a message. I knocked at the door. Nobody answered. I opened the door. Everything was empty. There was no furniture, no nothing. I went upstairs, hearing voices. I knocked at the door. They told me to come in. There was four or five. I wish I could remember who they were, but I can't tell you who they were. And I gave my message. They were all sitting on chairs, some on boxes. There was nothing. Absolutely. On the 14th of July, 1940, Free France didn't even have a table in that building. Or if they had, it was well hidden. So on the next day, on the 15th of July, I went to Delville and Morval camp. I stayed in Delville, actually, which were two Free French camps near Aldershot, near a place called Cowes, I think. In those days, it existed. It was along the railway line, not far from the La Chaudière Canadian Regiment, where they came up walking up the tracks. They were used to come to see us sometime. So I was there. I was in the artillery for 4 days. Didn't like it. Went to see General Magrin Verneret, who became Montclar. He was a foreign legion. He was the one in charge of the camp. I said, I didn't like to stay. I was only a private, of course. I didn't like to stay in there. So he said, well, never mind. What were you in the Merchant Navy? I said, well, I was an engineer. He said, all right, well, I'll make you sergeant and you go in the Foreign Legion. Well, good job, I knew what the Foreign Legion was like. I didn't like to say nothing yet. I went to the barracks of the Foreign Legion, like if I wanted to go. And I knew, I mean, a young boy like chap like me at the Foreign Legion, I wouldn't have lasted a day. So I came back to him and I said to him, mon colonel, I cannot go in the Foreign Legion. He said, what the deuce do you want to be? So I said, well, the girl went in the tank corps, I go in the tank corps. So he said, all right, private in the tank corps. Well, I went in the tank corps. That's why I got my number 1835 of the Free French Army, the 13th of August, 1940. Then I was in the tank corps with some very, they were in the tank corps, it was called the Gentleman Battalion, not because I was there, but it had a lot of very famous French names in it, Becourt Foch and all that. And we left on the 30th of August, we left the camp. We had received all our colonial equipment, British helmet with a free French bag, you probably saw them, a triangular badge, bleu, blanc, rouge, on our helmet. And of course, everybody should have known, we were not going to the Arctic. And the night before we left, the sergeant, our sergeant of the repair shops, and my wife is with me, she managed to escape from France through Dunkirk with him. What could we do? I'd like for her to come. So we cut her hair, we dressed her as a man, we took her with us on board the train. When we got to Liverpool on the 31st of August, we climbed the ship with her between us as a man, and she wasn't discovered until we sailed. Madame Batajo, her name was. And the night we were sailing from Liverpool, we were attacked by the Luftwaffe. There was quite a heavy bombardment in the docks. They had claimed, they say, they would not let us sail. So we sailed from Liverpool. When I joined the Free French, I was asked for, did I wanted to become Canadian? I said, no. Do you want to change your name? I said, no. But I was an only son, and my parents were in the French West Indies. So somebody said, a friend of mine said, get older. So I, as you will see, I said I was born in 1916 instead of 21. That was fine. But that meant I had done my military service. That done, I knew all about military life. So I had to learn quickly to walk or to salute and all that in all the shop before we left, because frankly, I had no knowledge. However, we were inspected by the king on the 25th of August, if I remember right, just a week before we left. And then we left for Dakar. I won't tell you all about it, because on Dakar, we thought we would be well received. On my ship, the Penland, the goal was on the Western Land. There were two Dutch liners. There were three French warships, the Commandant Duboc, the Commandant Dominé, and the Savoyan Brazza, and a trawler called President Oudus. Four cargo ships carrying all our, we had 12 tanks, we had 675 guns, we had 525 anti-tank rifle. All came from Narvik. We had got it in London. But they were in those four cargo ships. You can see nobody thought of landing in Dakar, because we would have had to empty the cargo ship before we could get to our heavy equipment. During the trip, the journey, we even had music on the deck. We were to show us how we were going to have to parade in Dakar and on this and that. So we went to Freetown first. We got to Freetown on the 17th of September. And on the 21st of September, we sailed for Dakar. We arrived in Dakar on the 23rd of September. Well, you probably know all about it. The Richelieu refused to let us get in. The Duboc and the Dominé went inside the Dakar harbor. When Captain d'Argentlieu and others went on two little vedette launches with white flag. And when they got to the dock to present de Gaulle's letter, please let you know, we're coming in peace and all that, they wanted to arrest them. So they jumped back into the launches and took off. And somebody fired at them, and two of the person on board, D'Argentlieu, were wounded. At that time, the Duboc and the Dominé, the two small sloops, went into alongside the Richelieu, and it was quite strange because apparently some people on the Richelieu even saluted them and all that. But a battery ashore began to open fire, so they escaped quickly. The same night, they went to Rufisque, where we were supposed to land with our French Marine and our Foreign Legion. The Duboc moored in Rufisque. A battery opened fire. We had 3 dead and 5 wounded. The ship, 13.2 machine gun, was completely blown up. And we managed to escape and pick up some of the embarkation, which had already some fusiliers, some French Marines on board ready to land. Because we thought it would have been easy. In fact, three of our pilots took off and went to Dakar airfield, hoping to talk with their other airmen, French airmen. They were arrested and they were deported to France afterward, de Bois Lambert and all that. It was quite a mess because De Gaulle always wanted for us to go through by land, through Bathurst and all that. But for some reason, Sir Winston Churchill and some high ranking whoever, I'd prefer a sea presence because they felt a sea presence would attract everybody to come. But what they had done too wrong, they left several French cruisers, Nivichi cruiser, go through Gibraltar Strait. And before Churchill or anybody, I think a certain delay in the signal. In fact, I think that whoever was in charge in Gibraltar, I think, was recalled home and changed. All those cruisers came down, and the British fleet, we had the Barrams, the Resolutions, the Ark Royal, and all that. It was quite a big fleet. We had 2 Polish ships with a Polish Legion, First Army going to Egypt, I suppose. Anyway, the British ships managed to have the French cruiser go back home, but 1 or 2 managed to get into Dakar. The Richelieu had been attacked same time as Merseul-Kébir a few days later by some fleet air arm and damaged. So, of course, people on the Richelieu were not exactly pro-British. All this played, and Dakar was a mess. A Resolution was torpedoed by the Beveziers and all that. So, finally, we came back to Freetown. We stayed in Freetown from the 28th to the 28th of September until the 7th of October when we were taken to Victoria in Nigeria. We were told to go there. Our transport, our warship, everything went there. All the rest of the British fleet and the Polish had left for wherever they were going. And on the 8th of October, the French Cameroon had said they wanted to become free French, thanks to Colonel Leclerc, who actually was a captain, but to make things better, he presented himself as a colonel, and he was declared colonel after that. So De Gaulle boarded the Duboc to enter Douala. I was part of the guard from the tank corps sent on the Duboc to present arm when we would get to Douala. So off we took for Douala. The rest would come later, was the guy. While I was on the platform of the 13.2 machine gun, there was a small ladder to the main deck. I came down that ladder, and somebody was coming up, and that was De Gaulle. I was terrified for a second because he said to me, my son, at last France, because we were practically in Douala. You could see the tirailleurs and everybody there. And I saw like a tear in the corner of his eye. After that, I never was afraid of De Gaulle because I realized no matter what they say, he was a human being like everybody else. So we got to Douala, received by the tirailleurs, by Leclerc, by Colonel Parent and all that. De Gaulle went ashore, we went ashore, we were, that night we had a terrific binge in the only hotel of Douala, which was put out of band afterward to anything but the officers. We stayed in Douala on the docks in where they were used to store goods. It was hot. Oh, along the river Wouri there, we all had all kind of problems, skin problem and all that. Anyway, we stayed there. We went to the Campagne du Gabon. We went to the Gabon. Libreville in the Gabon was attacked by the Savoyan de Brazza and the Dominé. The Bougainville was a vicious ship, same as the Savoyan de Brazza sloop, was sunk by the Brazza. Finally, Libreville airfield was captured by the Legion. We attacked by land with six tanks. We left Douala and by road. We managed to get to the Gabon. Took us quite a while, crossing rivers on canoes with planks on board, put a 12-ton tanks on that and across rivers. We managed to get to Midzik, which was in the Gabon. And in the meantime, Lambaréné was captured, Briberville captured. So we came back to Douala. By then, I had enough of the army. I asked to go back to the Navy, which was my right, because I was a merchantman before that. The colonel Parent said, no, Olivier will not do any good in the Navy, because if he's not doing any good in the army, he won't do any good in the Navy. So I came to an agreement with Captain Bourgin in charge of the sloop Duboc, and he said to me, look, he had said to me when we came to Douala first, if I really wanted to come back to the Navy, he would call. I said, I want to go back to the Navy. He said, okay, come at night. I will put you I had you on board and finished. So I left all my equipment, everything, so I could not be in danger of having stolen government good. In my short and thing, I went on board the Duboc at night. Commandant Bourgin said, now you are a quartermaster engineer on board, my ship. And we took off. We were going to patrol off Ferdinandpo and all that. We were not supposed to come back to Douala. Unfortunately, 2 days later, we were back in Douala. And there was a big thing in the city that Olivier had deserted. And all that. So I went ashore, always escorted by two of my shipmates, because if I had been arrested, he would have come and liberated me, because you must remember, you must know that in the beginning of Free France, things were, especially in Africa, I mean, not in England, things were a bit tense when something went wrong. For example, La Porte des Vaux, who commanded the Dominé, when the paymaster didn't bring the pay of his for his crew, he gave them half an hour, otherwise he would open fire. In those days, you could get away with murder, shall we say. It didn't last long, but for a few weeks, it was like that. La Porte des Vaux went elephant hunting with hand grenade and a brand gun, and he brought back a dead elephant, but it was an elephant working for the rubber plantation. Nobody told him it was not a wild elephant. He brought the ears and he hanged it at the gangway to his ship. It stank to heaven. That was how it was then. So I deserted, and nobody chased me. I studied on board the ship. So we finally left for Libreville. The Christmas Eve on Libreville, no, New Year's Eve in Libreville, Captain Schlumberger, number two of the Duboc, asked a few volunteers to go dive inside at night, inside the Bougainville, which was on the rock there. And nobody could go to it normally because it was a Dutch firm which was supposed to do the job. So we put ourselves in our trunks, swam 300 or 400 meters in the water in the dark to the Bougainville. He had torches. He went inside, and we managed to come back with 2 bottles of champagne, which was a great thing for those days, 2 bottles of champagne. We didn't have any. And a few days later, we left for Pointe Noire, and then we went to South Africa. On the way to South Africa, we met a large auxiliary cruiser, British, and again, La Porte des Vaux, with its little 300-ton ship, rushed to it and said, oh, show your flag or I open fire. La Porte des Vaux was one of the best characters we had in the Free French. He was a carrier officer in the Free French Navy. He did the most stupid things, But he, at least he kept us laughing in a certain special spirit, and he was very brave. When we got to South Africa, they asked for volunteers for submarines, and a few of us volunteers. We came back to England on the SS Narkunda. It was a P&O liner. She came. She was coming from Singapore, loaded with wives and children from there. The Japanese were not at war yet, with, of course. And I got to England in at the end of March. We were in London. The Blitz were on still. And I was sent to Plymouth on the submarine Surcouf, the biggest submarine in the world in those days. I arrived 2 days before the big Plymouth Blitz, because Plymouth, for 7 days, we were absolutely blitzed out.
Can you describe it?
Well, it was at night, and I don't know how many planes came, but the Blitz lasted for hours. I mean, the first night of the Blitz, we were at the YMCA. I left it. I said, I'm not staying there. When I came back 2 hours later, the YMCA was down. The dockyard, everything was completely destroyed. There was a British cruiser which had a bomb in Bardia or somewhere. It had just been finished repaired. She got another bomb, same place, more or less. Our submarine received a lot of shrapnel. I was wounded there, actually. And the best thing in Plymouth was there was a bridge in Plymouth. I can't remember where. And the best thing, I think the Germans were trying to destroy it, and we always said the best place to be was to be under that bridge, because they never hit it. They were dropping mine with parachute. We discovered what it was. We had never seen this drop like that before. Not us, anyway. And actually, Plymouth was on fire. I mean, I remember we tried to help a chap who was selling paint to save his paint, and then an incendiary fell, and the whole lot of paint caught fire. It went all down the street. Some chap managed to go into a pub because we were bombed out, and managed to have a few free drinks on the bombardment and all sorts. But the Plymouth Blitz were really the worst blitz I had seen on a short scale, because it only lasted a week. I had seen it in Liverpool, but it was nothing as, in my mind, as bad as the one in Plymouth. When I came back from Africa, one thing I must make it clear, because I was not in the Navy when I left Africa, but in the Army, when I came back from Africa, I was given a new number, 5155. 41. I was in the Free French since 40, but I was declared for the Navy only since 41, which I was pretty mad. When the ships came back, they all got their numbers from 40, but we were only five guys, and nobody there to defend us, so we were forced to take, like if we were newly arrived in the Free France. So that's why I got the other number you see there. And from the Surcouf, they discovered I had tuberculosis. So I was sent to Royal Naval Hospital, Newton Abbott, in a little room close to Torquay. And we were only in a small room there. Three of us, there was a Canadian, another chap, and I. And we were kept in bed, not moving, not doing anything, forcefully fed, bottle of start a day, and nobody could come to see us except putting a mask on. I'll tell you, that for young people like we were, it was quite a way of life.